How many children would come and tell you when they lost their virginity?
That's true. Oh, my gosh.
Can they hear the fact that I'm blushing?
Touch the Muppet Baby.
May the force be with you.
Because when I die, it's going to piss me off.
Oh, picturing my 2-year-old, the freedom to get all red-faced in the middle of the living room and just launch some ass candy into his diaper.
I never want to eat candy again.
Shut your face!
It's like, just like, why are you such an ass?
But it, deep down, I'm like, I'm always surprised that people listen.
And now look at us. We're doing an iPod in the dining room.
Never gets old.
That will never not make me laugh. Doing an iPod in the dining room.
We'll bring it right in. Bruce Smith, as you read in the description. I did it again.
You did it. Wow,
description.
Yeah.
I'm not ready to be introduced like that.
All right, I apologize. You want to start over? We can start over and see.
Yeah. No kidding.
How many children?
Well, no, I didn't put it. I did.
Oh, good.
Good.
You know, but we're going to have to listen to the whole thing.
Yeah. I'd never heard it before, and now I can actually say it's never ceased to make me laugh.
It is batting 1,000 with you. Yes.
Speaking of batting 1,000. And tell us about the description.
Bruce Smith is our guest here, is what I was going to say. And then I was explained is that was my wife who you just met. Mm-hmm. She was talking about, she mistakenly called this an iPod. She didn't understand the podcast term or any of that.
There's several things she doesn't understand.
She doesn't understand that when she, it's convenient now that she's busy out of the house now, because she doesn't understand that when she's not in front of a microphone, she cannot be heard. She doesn't understand that aspect of the show, but she insists on chiming in if whenever the occasion arises.
She should be an agent or a manager. I also have that problem.
And that's true. To give a little bit of background on Bruce, and correct me here if I'm overstepping my bounds at all, but a lot of our listeners are huge fans of my favorite podcast, which is Never Not Funny. Bruce manages Jimmy Pardo, who's the host of that podcast. Also, some other clients of yours are Doug Benson, Maria Bamford, Andy Kindler. Who else? Oscar Nunez from The Office, who everybody
Josh
knows.
Josh Leggero.
Where
would I know her from? that's Chelsea Lately.
Oh,
and,
okay.
She's got a show coming out on Comedy Central called Ugly Americans. And you're making me plug now.
I'm not actually making me plug.
You're making me do a resume.
That's how good I am.
This is Monster.com, the audio podcast.
I don't know. Do you know DeRay Davis? Do you know
who
he is?
No, I don't.
Okay. He's been in a lot of stuff, and he takes a great deal of pride. He used to live down the hall from me in an apartment building, and he invented what I call the drive-by resume,
nice.
Which is, it's like you open the door to get the newspaper, and he goes, okay, don't miss me on Reno 911 tonight. And he's gone. He's gone.
What's he doing out in front of my house when I get my paper?
Yeah, what if it's just not your neighbor that he's doing that to? Yeah, he goes on a walk.
Right. Actually, where he's headed, he's going down the entire row of apartments, and
right.
he's going to take on the neighborhood.
That's awesome.
And everybody's watching.
Grassroots promotions. Yeah.
Right, when he comes by the next morning, you better tell him what you thought. And it better be good.
And you know, speaking of that, too, because I'm interested in this. Right before we fired up the microphones, you were talking a little bit about, I said, how was your day? And you were like, well, it seems like everything started all over again, because you're in the middle of getting ready for pilot season.
It has overrun me.
It's
a little earlier than usual in terms of comedy.
So if for the sake of just, I know it's repetitive because we already talked about it. We didn't do the SIFTA, but
SIFTA.
You were talking
makes
about.
Makes you think I don't repeat myself all day before.
When he was telling us it was already a canned speech.
He's already prepared.
Exactly. I sell for a living. It's like you hang up the phone and then you say the exact same thing to the next person.
Oh, that's good. I got to bookmark that too. So you were saying that there's these out of nowhere, like these comedies came up. And so now there's like this overflux of networks going, we want comedies, we want comedies, we want comedies.
See, but here's the great thing is that, you know, you can be on the outside of it and it's almost like being on the inside. Like I've got... 3 pilots to take home and read tonight, and I read 3 last night, and you're reading this thing. Okay, let's see. So somebody is orphaned at birth, you know, and then they grow up and they realize, oh, you know, my family's around, you know, that I'm not an orphan. Uh-huh. And they go and they seek out the family, and you go, wait a minute, wasn't this like on in the 70s?
Yeah.
somebody gets divorced and they move in with their parents, you know, even though they're 40 years old. It's like, doesn't happen that much in real life, but it happens shockingly over and over again in the television.
Now, do you think that that's a lot of parallel thinking in the sense that these people who are entertaining end up coming up with similar ideas? Or do you think it's honestly because networks are like, we knew this worked 30, 40 years ago. Yeah. We want something like it again.
I think, you know, Bob Dylan said something years ago about, you know, it's not plagiarism. Like, there's just ideas whose time has come. And, you know, everybody kind of reaches up and grabs the idea kind of out of the ether at the same time. It's nothing like that explanation.
that was real
so
poetry.
Creative, yeah. Poetic. You know, this is nothing like that. This is much more about you're kind of reaching for an idea that you know the network will like, and you know that the network is made up of business school graduates, not necessarily people who studied creative writing.
Yeah.
Right.
So the easiest way to approach them and the easiest way to get them on your side is very often to pitch them something that sounds familiar. You know, you don't go in and say, okay, today we're going to be pitching you Friends.
Right.
You go in and you pitch a show with six people,
right,
three of whom are girls, three of whom are guys, and they all have different names. And people go, I like the sound of it.
That's an aspect of the pitch. You have to clarify.
It sounds like a hit. Years ago, I was up in Montreal, and it was the first time ever I'd seen Steve Harvey. And somebody came up to me, and they go, he looks just like a star. And I go, yes, Richard Pryor. And you gotta go, well, but he does look like a star.
Yeah.
Now, these sitcoms that you're reading, are they for your talent that you represent, yeah, or?
I'm always reading to, you know what I'm getting people into.
Got it.
And that doesn't mean I'll stop myself from getting them into it. But you know, everybody wants a job, and
right,
you know, and it could, you know, even a mediocre sitcom that doesn't get on the air could be a break for somebody. Could be a good break, you know, because it kind of puts them on the network radar. So, you know, there's no shame in it. I mean, you know, to me, there's more shame in being Meryl Streep and Alec Baldwin and making It's Complicated, you know.
It's, wow.
They have a choice. They don't need to read crap and think that it's good.
That's a valid point, I think. You know, that it's like, because you see that. It's like Adam Carolla has that thing that he talks about, that he feels like if Nicolas Cage's Oscar was made out of chocolate and he had to take a bite out of it for every time he made a crappy movie after leaving Las Vegas. Was that the name of it? Yeah. Did I get it right? Yeah. After that Oscar would be gone then, and he couldn't use it. He couldn't be called an Oscar winner anymore in the previews of anything. You know, he's like, Bangkok Dangerous, that's it. You know,
and that was the feat. Bad skin from all the chocolate.
Exactly.
Oh, wait, already does.
And it's true, because it's like, you know, if you have a guy like, well, I'll use myself as an example. Like, if I get a chance at any pilot, I don't care if it's six people with all the same name, I'm in. You know what I mean?
You have a position, you know, like as you're kind of moving up in the rank, where you're not really being judged very harshly. You know, nobody's really thinking, why would this guy take a part like that?
Yeah.
I think that sometimes, like when I see a De Niro movie, you know, Showtime, when I saw like De Niro and Eddie Murphy in Showtime, I'm like, well, why did they take those parts? You know, it's like they both done them before in better written movies, and, you know, they don't need to be here. Eddie Murphy doesn't need to do a bad version of Beverly Hills Cop. Why? And the answer is paycheck. Somebody offered it, you know. The thing that's hard to wrap your mind around is like when people are famous, they do have choices and they really read these scripts. And if they didn't do this, they could have done something else. So you realize that even when people are really super rich, they still want more money.
Really?
You know, it's never quite enough.
I gave them the benefit of the doubt and thought maybe it was because they just like the part. I don't care if it's going to be bad. It sounded like fun to play and get to be on set with Alec Baldwin. Why not?
Well, yeah. I mean, there was a script a couple of years ago that I read. I'm trying to remember what it was. It was called Jezebel James, like The Return of Jezebel James or something. And it was for Fox, and it was a pilot. And I read it, and it was all about like a sister who convinces her younger sister to carry her baby for her. And I thought, this is the worst god-awful pilot I've read this year. Flash forward a month to Parker Posey signing on to play the role and saying to the press, you know, people offer me TV scripts all the time, and I love to do movies. You know, movies are really my thing, and this script was so great, I couldn't say no. And I go, you need to read more TV scripts. Maybe that's the problem.
Now, just out of curiosity, because from where you're coming from, how do you find yourself dealing with your clients in a situation where it's like, something comes in, they want to do it, and you're like, listen, you're at a level now where you don't have to do this kind of thing, or, and how...
Yeah, it works both ways. you know, like you mentioned Andy Kindler and Doug Benson, both of them have always been very kind of picky and very choosy. And then I do have clients, you know, to the other side where I feel like I'm trying to talk them out of things.
Yeah.
With Andy and Doug, I always feel like, you know, I'm putting on my, you know, kind of devil ears and my pitchfork and kind of going, come on, sell out. Sell out, for God's sakes. Couldn't hurt you.
It's, I'm,
you know, but you know, it really does work the other way where I've got a huge part of the roster where it's like, don't, oh, for God's sakes, don't do that part.
Please stop.
That's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
That make, and it, because, I'm stumbling because I'm trying to figure out where is the line, you know, because I'm sure that there are just as many examples of people who took something that maybe they shouldn't have and then it worked out for them. But then there's
that'd be Carrot Top's whole career.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. So
everything was wrong, and yet it made a big pile of money.
Yeah. Which, by the way, I saw that movie at a hotel room somewhere.
The Biodome?
No, the one that he. It was about
Chairman
him.
Of the board.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, oh, wow. It was that. Where
it was
and
the
it's
first of a 3-picture deal where the second and third picture never got made.
Yeah.
Really?
After that.
Oh wow.
Wow.
I think it was New Line. I can't remember. I remember it was like a big thing. Carrot Top gets 3-picture deal and. I remember thinking, don't you want to see how the first one goes?
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened.
Well, and it's so crazy. I mean, I know it's been beat to death, but like you forget. Like you yeah. forget what he used to look like. And it's and when I see him now, like I always thought, I'm like, wow, he looks like a completely different person. But when you see him in this movie, you could see that his face is in there somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, so you do kind of go, oh, well, it does look, he didn't look, it's not as crazy, except for like the musculature. Like it is crazy yeah. big, but that. And that movie was awful. Yeah, no wonder yeah. they stopped there.
That's, I can't believe you saw it.
I admit it. Here's what happens when you're in the hotel room and you don't have the benefit of TiVo and you come back from doing two shows and you just don't feel like going to sleep, then you will watch Chairman of the Board.
Or Sex in the City and Meerkat Manor. That's what I end up with.
And
I'm starting to sound good.
And after the week that I just spent in San Antonio where there was no cable connection, I think that just lowered my bar even more. Mm. I might watch something worse than Chairman of the Board next time I'm in a hotel room because I'll be just so thankful to
that
have some
form a lot
of
because you watch, and no disrespect, but you watch some crappy television as it is.
How dare you?
I just watch an hour of Cake Boss and you watch Little Big People or whatever that show is.
No, hold on. Hold on.
Come on. It's
Cake
it's,
Boss is quality entertainment. Those are people with a gift that make cakes, number one.
Low ranking reality TV.
Number two,
show.
How it's like the guy is like a godfather. He's from Jersey and he's Italian. We got to make these cakes over here.
I don't know.
How is that not entertaining?
I would rather watch a bad sitcom with an intentional plot than some editors trying to force some storyline together
you,
any day of the week.
You, sir, are wrong. And luckily, here on this episode, I have a man of the industry who is here to back me up, right? Right. Cake Boss is quality
when
entertainment.
When I was a kid and my mother used to make a cake, I was thinking, yeah, this is kind of boring. The eating part is good.
Yeah. But,
which but you can't do when you watch TV.
Yeah, I remember I used to just sit at the table going, I'm hungry. You know, it's like, and the cake wasn't happening fast enough.
Right.
And the thing about TV is the cake happens faster.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
And for more camera angles.
But you never get to taste it. So the actual point of the cake
payoff
is
not
to eat
good.
It. Yeah. You just watch it happen.
But it's all the enjoyment without any calories. You know what I mean? If you're a man such as myself
right.
who's trying to drop
weight. About Little Big People, that show that follows the family of dwarves that live out in the wilderness.
They have a farm and they raise pumpkins and they're little people.
Have you seen this show?
I have not.
Yeah, that's about it. Oh, I'm sorry, Little People.
We got to get you a script from this show. You're going to love it.
You would consider me the swing vote in this situation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's just going to be your. We didn't plan this, but now you've officially become. No. It's good. I haven't seen it.
Yeah. Do you watch any
I'm
reality
only doing
TV?
His podcast.
Exactly. Bring your mic up.
No, you know what? I really genuinely, not because it infringes on my ability
right.
to make a living, but I hate reality TV. Mm-hmm. I hate it with a passion. Hated it from day one. And you know, it's like, I remember like, you know, when I was a kid, like probably like one of the first real reality shows that was on, like when I was a little kid was the Loud Family, the American Family on PBS. And that was when, if you've ever seen Albert Brooks' movie, Real Life, that was what they were taking off on. Which was the Loud Family, was camera crew kind of moves in with the
right.
family, and then the son comes out and he's gay, and the parents go through a divorce and split up on camera. And
Eek.
What's funny about it is it's probably like the late 70s, I think, and you'd think like a light bulb would go off over somebody's head and they would go, I think we're onto something.
Right.
I mean, it was the cover of Time magazine. fast forward 20 years before anybody jumps on the bandwagon.
Because it was real world.
They've forgotten it.
On MTV before I remember any new reality show. I don't know if there's something before.
Would certainly be an early one. Just like, I mean, you know, there's always sort of something historically that, you know, came before.
I mean, Cops, you know, was there.
You look at American Idol and you go Star Search, but, you know, I mean, somebody else might say Ted Mack's Amateur Hour.
Right.
It's really, you know, it's all connective tissue.
Right.
You
know? Yeah. There's only so much programming. It all goes back to the Today Show and the Tonight Show.
Yeah. Wait, what?
Now we're getting, that's now we're getting back to those sitcoms and why they can't break the mold.
Right.
Well, speaking of which, on that, I saw Saturday Night Live, and I don't even know if this is true, and I'm the victim of their bit, but evidently Sigourney Weaver father was the network executive of NBC. Yeah. That
Pat Weaver.
Yeah, he was the one who kind of, I don't think he created, but he was the one who greenlit the Tonight Show. Am I right on that?
That's true. Yeah.
And she read a letter.
Sylvester? It's either Sylvester Pat Weaver or Pat Sylvester Weaver. I can't remember.
I think it's Pat. Yeah. She called him Pat Weaver on the show.
Yeah, so it's Sylvester, Pat, I think, might have been like a nickname kind of thing. Yeah.
So anyway, she has this letter. She goes, I have this letter that my father wrote as a memo to say that we're greenlighting the show. And he goes, The Tonight Show will be a show that is not about controversy, that it's like, it's just something for people to laugh at the end of their day. That's there will be no, like...
unless your name is Conan O'Brien.
Yeah, exactly.
In which case, you will weep like no tomorrow.
I'm always curious to see, because...
Yeah, exactly.
I'm always curious to see, because, like, that's what I mean. It's like, it seems like it's history repeating itself.
Totally.
And the Letterman thing happens with The Tonight Show, and so then it seemed like such a smooth transition that was like... plan 5 years out, that it's like we know exactly what's going to happen.
And I remember when he said that, I was like, oh, I was hoping, I honestly in the back of my mind thought, oh, I was hoping for more drama when the host leaves.
Well, you got it. You know, congratulations, like, Kevin, your little karmatic spin of your head, you secreted Conan O'Brien
like
out of the
10
show
at the time. Come
and inadvertently, this poor man's client, Jimmy Pardo, he bought a house. You son of a bitch, how dare you.
I was actually thinking, you know, it's like when The Late Show was over, I'm not ready to leave these characters. I've kind of grown accustomed to them. And why does the story have to end now? Yeah. Flash forward 15 years. Bill Carter's getting out his pencil.
The sequel.
One of the other things, too, that I wanted to kind of pick your brain about, because I think this kind of does the same thing with the difference, because that's what I felt like this whole Tonight Show was about and what I was so excited about, is that I think Conan represents kind of like an old, or not Conan, I'm sorry, Leno represents, in my opinion, an older generation of comedy. Yeah. And Conan is more for, like, the younger up-and-coming, and which I think now, it started off being coined as, like, the alternative comedy scene. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's fair to call it alternative, because I feel like it's become even a little bit more the mainstream, you know what I mean?
And he grew out of National Lampoon.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
SNL. So I think, you know, anything that seems rebellious at any point, mm-hmm. I mean, in any kind of... art movement, if you will, you know, like whether it's comedy or literature or painting, anything that seems rebellious eventually will kind of get some traction and gravitate towards center. So with Conan, you know, I mean, I think as you go from him being kind of this hero to people who, you know, are in their dormitories watching, you know, at 12:30 at night, you know, and then flash forward, you know, almost 20 years later, and, you know, they're all adults with kids and everything.
Exactly.
You know, they represent the status quo now.
Right.
And the shocking thing is that there's a bigger status quo represented by Jay, which I like to think of as the same people who were stupid enough to put George Bush in office twice. You know, that, like, they didn't learn the first time, and they went back and did it again. What was it you liked about his politics? Well, he's a churchgoer. He's a reformed drunk. You know, and that's the thing. You know, you realize a good deal of America. Nobody listens to this podcast, but a good deal of America.
That means eventually we're going to become the center.
Yes.
That's good. I like
that's
this.
Right.
We're rebellious.
Oh, we're so against the normal podcast show.
We're rebellious in our desire
different.
To have mass downloads.
That's right.
But I see it as like there's two status quos. You know, like Conan is sort of like the kind of kooky, offbeat, you know, kind of juvenile status quo. And Jay Leno kind of has this big meat and potatoes contingency of people who would never really stop and analyze the fact that at the end of an hour, not one legitimately funny thought was crossed his lips.
Yeah. And that was what was so frustrating, is I watched the show at 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And because I'd heard what a train wreck it was, and it was, I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, a little stunning.
I was seriously, I was like,
and he listens to everything. He's listening now. Yeah. He has spies. He's like a...
Wait, are you a spy?
I'm in the sanctum.
You're deep.
I'm really deep. It's like in that movie Sliver with Sharon Stone where what's his name? Alec Guinness.
I've got to see that movie.
It's not Alec Baldwin, is it?
Baldwin's
it is
brother.
Baldwin?
It's
I think it was
Billy
Stephen.
Baldwin.
Oh, it was Billy? Okay.
Yeah. Billy Baldwin plays this guy who like runs an apartment complex, and he's got like 20 TVs, and like he's really like bugged everybody's apartment, and he's watching what everybody's doing.
Yep.
That's Jay Leno. Except millions of monitors and bugs, and you know, this is the guy who hid in the closet.
That's what I wanted to know, because I'd heard that them talk about that on Stern, and that there were articles written that he would hide in closets and listen to the executives at NBC just to figure out what they thought of him. Like, you know what I mean? And so for me, like, I watched the show at 10 o'clock. I've seen a couple episodes of The Tonight Show, and I've seen moments where he's interviewing people, and I was like, oh, that's kind of amusing. Usually it's on the part of the guest, though. The guest brought something to the table. He just seemed to always agree with what
All right, that's good. Let's see a clip.
That's the thing, you know. It's like, I mean, there's certainly lots of different ways to be plugged in, and you know, I mean, like a lot of people of my generation, you know, it's like Letterman's a hero, you know. So somewhere along the line, unofficially, they became opposing camps,
right?
You know. Which you know, if I go back 20 years, I don't think of them that way. And, you know, 20 years ago, they were both kind of hip comics, and Leno had a lot of street cred back then. And then it sort of became like, you know, are you campaigning for Middle America? And the irony of it is that Leno's an East Coast, you know, Boston guy. And it's really Letterman who's the Midwest guy.
Right.
Letterman is the Indianapolis, you know, Ball State grad. And, you know, it's funny how their positions kind of got twisted the opposite way with the audience, where Letterman is like now seen more as, you know, in the camp of kind of like a snooty big city guy, you know, and Leno represents.
He's very much New York. Like, I think, like, it's like they joke about him, and everybody knows he's from Indianapolis, but there's no, like, quote unquote, what the stereotypical Midwesterner is. There's no aspect of that to his personality.
No, he's very New York.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's funny how all that got lost, you know, because, you know, to me, I mean, I still see the Midwesterner, you know, that's part of his charm. It's just, you know, amplified so much in the, kind of icon status.
Well, and so the thing that bothered me about this, and this is entirely selfish, but that my brother-in-law was telling me about how much he hates Conan's Tonight Show, but he loves the show at 10 o'clock. And I said, well, enjoy it, because it's not going to last for the rest of the year. And he was like, what do you mean? I said, well, I said, they're going to cancel it. The ratings are horrible. Mm. And then they go, well, they should. And then this is what makes me most angry about it. He said, well, they should just give him back to Tonight Show. He was number one there. That's where he belongs. Conan can't have that. I'm like, no. NBC's going to have to cut Conan a $40 million check or more to take it away from him. And I said, the ball's already been set in motion. I said, Jay Leno's probably just going to walk away and just fade away and do his million-dollar weekends in Vegas and maybe go back to doing stand-up here and there, or maybe go to another network eventually when his contract expires. But I said, the show's not going to be on that much longer. And he's like, well, who thinks Conan is funny? And I was like, well, I do.
Yeah.
And people like me. I go, he started off when he was following Leno with it's the Late Late Show. That's the other one. That's Ferguson, right?
It was Late Night.
Late Night. Thank you. So Late Night, he had like what you were talking about, college kids in their dorms watching the show after the Tonight Show, which was for the quote unquote adults, you know, and things like that. And now people that were of that age are now grown up and adults and have kids and all that stuff. So I said, so now this is the new guard. This is where it's going. And then we got in this weird fight about what the Tonight Show does for comics and things like that. But then he goes, well, everybody I know watches the show at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I was like, and in my head, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to be able to laugh my ass off come February when this is all over.
Right.
And Leno, cause I'd already heard that there was talk that he wasn't going to make the whole year. Right.
Yeah. Right.
And so then lo and behold, all of a sudden it's like, they're going to shift the show back a half hour. And then I was like, oh, well, that's going to be weird. And that's not going to fix anything. And then when Conan, weirdly enough, does the right thing, the noble thing, and say, I'm not going to screw up the Tonight Show. I'm not going to be responsible for that happening on my watch.
It's a noble franchise. And,
yeah.
You know, he was trying to.
And then that would affect Jimmy Fallon, who took over for him. Like,
totally
all that
screws him.
Yeah, it screws everybody. And then poor Carson Daly, who nobody even considers. Like, that's the other joke.
No, I see nobody's worried about if he gets screwed.
Which is funny because I recently saw his show, too. And it's not even in the same talk show format. It's like shot on location at certain spots.
Oh, really?
There's, like, interstitial moments. dance and like, yeah, it's weird how they're doing
even
it.
Even insomniacs are kind of dancing around that program. but I love it, you know, like when you go, you know, everybody I know loves Leno. It's like I flash to like, you know, 1930s Germany. It's like everybody I know loves Hitler.
Wow.
You know, it's like everybody's going to the Hitler Youth Rally. What the hell's wrong with Hitler?
You just paralleled Leno with Hitler.
Well, in his defense,
I need to make my points in a way where they will not get lost.
You
I cannot take any chance that somebody will not understand the connection.
No, at the end of The Late Shift, that bad reality TV movie that was made after this whole thing happened the first time, they said that the Tonight Show was a damaged goods and they were going to offer it to Letterman, and he turned it down, and he stayed at CBS. You think something like that will happen now? Like, now it's damaged goods, and...
You know, you can't go back. Mm-hmm. You know, you really, you truly can never go home. And whatever happens when Leno goes back to The Tonight Show, it'll feel a little weird because of everything that happened in between.
Oh, yeah. How long do you know, what do you do for the records? It's like, he's been hosting the show for 35 years, almost.
Yeah, because it is.
Except those 6 months.
How do you celebrate anniversaries if you and your wife split up and then reconcile and get back together? You know what I mean? What anniversary
is out with clients who have left and come back?
Uh-huh.
Do you really? Yeah. I just count the number of total years we've been together. All right. I skip over the kind of...
Call those the dark years. It's what the Browns do, too, right?
You know what's funny about that is that
I erase it. Just erase it.
You just, you know, we won't even talk about it.
There was only 2004.
Yeah. How noble of you. If you really get down to it, you know, did he lose a year?
No, it's only 7 months. I didn't even come into the year.
I was still on NBC.
I was doing my own Tonight Show. I was bring it back to 11:30.
Another question. When they were pitching this concept of a 10 o'clock spot, why didn't they just pitch a different show, like something to buddy up with Saturday Night Live or a Friday night show? Why not something in its own time slot as opposed to taking over the news at 10?
Right. Well, it was something, you know, something somebody said to me really kind of stuck with me, which I think is really true. And I don't want to be picking on NBC in this scenario because in spite of the fact that I think they made the wrong move with Conan and Jay, NBC still carries a lot of programming that I genuinely enjoy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you ask me, what do you like in comedy? I certainly enjoy 30 Rock and The Office and even Community much more than I thought I was going to enjoy Community, you know, much more than what's going on the other networks with comedy. You know, it's like I can't really get behind 2.5 Men and Big Bang Theory, no matter how big they get.
Yeah.
And it's funny how, like, the biggest shows on television would have been shows that would have been canceled, like, 15 years
ago. Right, absolutely.
Because the erosion is so strong. And that's what I'm really getting at, which is you reach a point of desperation where you're making desperate moves.
Mm.
And the 10 o'clock move was a desperate move. It sounded maybe good to someone because they sold it as the programming will be cheaper. You know, that no matter what. You know, doing a week of The Tonight Show will be, you know, considerably cheaper than doing 5 nights of dramas at 10 o'clock.
That's true.
And that sounds also logical, but, you know, you see what the end result of it is. But what somebody had said to me was you have to get used to the idea that, you know, these networks that we grew up with, that in our lifetime, unless you cross the street and get hit by a bus, in our lifetime, you will see these networks go down because they're a product of another time, of another model.
Absolutely.
And that model doesn't work so well in the world of internet and in the world of video rentals and the world of cable television. And there's nothing you can do to stop the future. The future is always coming. even just now, as I said it, seconds later, it sounded antiquated.
Wow. It's blowing my mind.
Oh, man.
Wow.
I need to go take a nap.
He just made the future is coming an antiquated phrase.
That's so 5 seconds ago.
Really?
Why are you still talking about that?
I'm always the last one to get on board with everything. I might as well be in Europe. The way I catch up, like, I just don't
get
Japan. Anything.
They're just now hitting the 80s.
Really? That's probably closer to me then.
It's already the future there.
They're wearing two ties and hover cars. No, you didn't say Parks and Rec in your list of the Thursday night lineup on NBC, and why not?
Well, I feel like it's funny that we're getting him to dish this dirt.
I know,
like,
come on, hit us.
I don't have anybody on that show. I'll protect The Office. you know, it's really true because I have a client on The Office. I have Oscar Nunez, and, you know, I've kind of followed it from the very beginning, and you know, I've probably seen every episode. And, you know, you become protective of a show, yeah. like without realizing it's like, you know, this is my little show. This is my little piece of show business. And I'm not just watching it on TV. You know, this is something I'm really kind of tied at the wrist and ankle to.
Yeah.
And Parks and Recreation being a spinoff from, you know, being involved with Greg Daniels, you know, who does both shows, I just sort of felt that I think Greg Daniels is a much more brilliant mind than I could ever hope to be if I was a writer. And I loved King of the Hill and I loved The Office. And I thought, you know, he had his work cut out for him in adapting The Office from the British version.
Oh, right.
Yeah, which is so beloved. You know, you have to, you know, kind of get over that hump.
And we were huge fans in the
I remember seeing
that,
Steve
a little
Carell
resistance in the beginning. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
He was it first came out that he was going to play Ricky Gervais's character in the American version.
Yeah, and I thought.
And Jimmy Kimmel, he was on Jimmy Kimmel's show.
Oh,
and
really?
Jimmy Kimmel said, "What are you thinking?" Mm-hmm. Like, because he just come off 40-year-old Virgin, I think, at the time, and he was.
No, they were coming out concurrently.
No. Actually, what happened is that they had run 6 episodes. The Office had a short mid-season run.
Oh, okay.
And those 6 episodes were in the. Really in the basement. I mean, like terrible ratings. And then 40-Year-Old Virgin came out over the summertime. They had already picked it up. Like they'd already picked up The Office for another season, but they gave it a short order. And then 40-Year-Old Virgin really kind of put it over the top.
Really?
Where now, like, there was an audience for Steve Carell.
Yeah.
And that movie may have helped save the show.
Oh, yeah.
You know, then,
by
really
the way, you're saying, I think it
brought
did.
People into the tent, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I was in from the beginning because of my love for the British version.
Yeah,
and I just want to see, like, what is it that we are going to do to either A, like maintain or improve, or what I was more expecting to just make this horrible. Like, I felt like it was just going to get all mucked up and that the awkwardness. And now what was great is that they kind of followed the same storyline for that first season and a half, maybe two. Yeah.
They let go fast because
they did.
You know what it was?
Faster than I thought. Then they broke off in their own brilliantly,
There's a reason, and you can't go to the video store and rent it, which is the American version of Coupling.
Oh, really?
Yes, I've heard of it.
Coupling was also Reveille. Reveille did Coupling,
yeah.
And they also did The Office. And I think the lesson of Coupling, because I had a client on it, and I was there at every taping. And
The American Coupling.
And there's something that happens in American show business, which, you know, a lot of people refer to as kind of sniffing the glue, you know, which is you kind of work in this glue factory and you go, there's something very intoxicating in the air. But I would go to watch Coupling and like, it was a live audience show. And, you know, like everybody was down on the stage and everybody was watching it and the audience, you know, people buy their own crap, you know, like a warm-up comes out and he tells them, you got to laugh and we're going to do this again. And when we do it again, laugh even harder. And we do it the third time, laugh like you never heard it before. And they train the audience to be a bunch of, you know, gibbons and baboons. and then you buy the idea that something funny happened, even though you told them to laugh.
Yeah,
right.
And the audience starts getting charged up because it's a communal experience. You know, they're all there. It's like being in a movie theater together. It's different than watching at home.
And you have the feeling like you're on the TV show, too, because you're laughing. I played the part of the audience.
Yeah. But I was always the way Coupling worked, there was a very small floor. There was very little distance between the audience and the actors.
Mm.
And there was no room, like there are in so many sitcoms, to really have a lot of executives and people kind of standing, you know, in that space in between. So there was no room on the floor. So I would always watch it from the green room. And I would be watching, like, you know, completely disconnected from the audience.
Yeah, like a viewer
at home. And I would go, they're wrong. This is not funny.
Really?
This is not translating. And the problem was that they insisted on using the English scripts.
Oh, wow.
And the actual English scripts. You know, you can't just, you know, take out the word bird and insert the word girl and make something funny. You know, there's more going on in the way the English writing is happening. And that's the lesson they learned for The Office, is don't use the English script. You felt it a little bit in the pilot.
Yeah, the pilot
and
followed
like
it very
soon. The stapler and the Jell-O. And,
even some of the lines. Jenna Fischer says, what is it that I was to have stolen? I'm like, that's not an American phrase. Yeah, it worked when she said it, but not here. Yeah.
And I felt like
they went go fast.
I felt like when they really hit a solid stride where like they're taking it in a whole new direction, which I was bummed that she left, was that when they introduced that character that was the new HR person that was like the perfect love
that
interest
was just last
for Michael.
Season.
I was
they were way off track before that.
But I mean, I just remember watching that and saying, because I knew that they, but I just felt like when they did that, I'm like, for whatever reason, me watching it, I was like,
Now, like, this is official. Like, this
Got
is
it.
It's its own show. They're doing something that would never have been done even right. on the British version. Like, I don't know why. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah, I just felt like that was the moment for me. And then I was kind of bummed out when she, like, went away. I was like, because it was perfect. Like,
I think she's the series closer. That's the feeling. The way they hint at
her. They packed her away.
They keep it. And then when the show's ready to wrap up, you bring her around to end the whole thing. What was up with the clip show this week? Come on. What is the deal?
Everybody needs
you understand
paycheck.
He is not Greg Daniels, right? You understand?
I don't call the shot, but when they say, is there a week where your client can do less work and make the same money? I go, I suppose a week like that would exist. You know, that could happen.
We can find one of those in 52 weeks, I'm sure.
No, I think what it actually was is, you know, most shows will go, they'll start up in August, and then they'll kind of run straight through till March, and then they take their hiatus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those shows that they shot will stay on the air till May to sweeps. And, you know, you're usually like about five shows ahead. And what happened this year is Steve Carell was doing a movie. So from mid-October through the end of December, The Office was out of production.
Oh, wow.
And then went back in after the holidays on January 4th. So I think what you had is a situation where they were just behind, where there were too many reruns, and I think they wanted to put something sort of new into the mix.
That makes sense. And that probably took them 2 days to shoot everything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, now as we're speaking, at this moment in time, which just passed.
It's already antiquated.
My mind is now clear.
I think now they've got about four shows in the can.
Oh,
so,
got it.
You know, so you'll see, like, starting this week, you know, there'll be, like, all new shows again.
A real episode. Yeah. Got it.
That's crazy. Well, and one of the things, I feel like I realized we just went on a long tangent, because I did want to talk to you about what started us on this whole thing was the difference in, like, alternative comedy and how that first came about. I know you started to touch on
it. As long as I'm off
the
hook on Parks and Recreation.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you're golden. Enough said.
Oh, I didn't mean to get you in trouble there. No. I still have more questions about The Office. This is going to be great.
I think, you know, in a nutshell, Parks and Rec, it was just the disappointment was just that they imitated the style.
Yeah,
absolutely. The first
episode. If they had just done something completely original and created a different world, I'd really have no beef.
The only reason I watch it is because it is kind of like you're stealing a dub of The Office.
Yeah.
Like it feels like you're getting another half hour.
It's weird. It's
of that same kind of humor.
It was sort of an unnecessary creative choice because I think it would have worked just fine. You know, like there's going to be a point where critics are going to go, no, that's it. Nobody's allowed to talk to camera. Even on the news, turn your back to us.
Talk to somebody else about it.
Anybody else talking profile. But you cannot talk straight to camera.
We have to reestablish a fourth wall, people. All right? We're done with this.
We can even take pictures of people talking to the fourth wall. That will be acceptable.
Where did we as an audience get the balls to have that kind of connection with our performers?
The day I decided I was adopted is when I was talking to my family about The Office, and my older brother said, why is it that they're talking to the camera? What is that supposed to be? And I was like, are you kidding?
They're Jack Benny and George Burns fans.
Exactly.
They're just trying to recreate a moment from their youth.
There has to be somebody. There has to be somebody who has watched The Office or Parks and Rec and is like, oh my gosh, Steve Carell, he's a big movie star. He keeps burning the lens. Like they know enough to know that you're not supposed to look at it, but they don't get what's going on.
They completely miss it, yeah. That would be somebody in my family.
My brother-in-law. I'm going to go back to the Leno fan. I would watch The Office, but Steve Carell doesn't know that he can't look at the camera. I mean, I don't understand how this guy has a career.
Your brother-in-law says it, does he go,
what's wrong with that? it's the fourth one.
Wait, are you related to Jay Leno? Is that your brother-in-law?
If I would, then it would. I don't know. I think I would have a sit down with him and go, Jay, brother.
Yeah,
brother to brother. You're okay, dude. You're okay. This guy moved his entire staff of like 200 or more people from across the country. Let it go, bro. Let it go.
It was manifest destiny. You know, it's like, you just have to eventually.
Oh gosh, but I am curious because I'm a huge fan of it. You know, like I'm going back to the alternative like comedy scene. Is that
you can tell that I'm going to refuse to talk about this. I keep changing the topic.
Is that really what's going on? And okay, good. Am I burning the lens? because I was...
So anyway, reality TV. Bunk a hole.
That would be great if you got it.
My goal in life is to have a microphone and pontificate on things that I know as little about as possible.
I've never even been to a taping of The Office.
I've always felt that a microphone is the key to being an expert.
It's true. Man, the things you know. Time, travel. Yeah.
And we can attest.
Take the mic away and I sound like an idiot. And then like with the microphone, I go, you know, amplification really takes me up a couple of IQ points.
Well, and I just so you know, I IQ'd you a little bit. Like, okay. I sweeten you up a little bit.
You
I bring
EQ'd
in that,
IQ,
low, that,
right.
that beautiful dulcet tone you got going on.
Wow, thank you.
There's a compressor on you. Sound great. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We're going to make it. It's going to be awesome. But anyway, because I started off when I came down here, I started doing stand-up here. Mm-hmm. And then I started working the road and everything like that. And I growing up, my comedic, the comics I loved were like Jeff Foxworthy, Bill Cosby, Robin Williams were the ones that I absolutely loved. And from there, I went on to Ray Romano. And then it was somewhere around the time that I found Never Not Funny, the podcast, and Jimmy has a ton of what I guess now that I learned to be called...
Alternative.
Yeah, alternative comics. And I loved them. Like, I like these guys. It's hilarious what they do. And it's like even like to talk about another client of yours, because even like Doug Benson, where I thoroughly enjoy him. And when I first heard about him, like I thought... Oh well, he's only a comic for like the quote unquote pothead or stoner of his marijuana logs.
That's,
and if you're listening to this podcast, if you're listening to this podcast, it couldn't be further from the truth. I now have all of his albums, and that dude. Not that I need to tell you, his manager. Let me explain to you how funny Doug Benson is.
Like, you know. Things were not looking good, but I'm turning around here.
Yeah. But it is like
a second look.
I'm telling you, Unbalanced Load is probably one of his better works. You should just take a listen.
Okay, I don't want to fight with you.
Listen, Bruce, I'm saying give this kid a chance. All right? I know if you could get him into something, I'm sure
I did
that it would
take
chance,
up. And he was a kid when I did it.
Really? How old was he? Age really, but
Knee
how long
pants.
Ago?
Yeah.
Knee pants. He came in cool. Locks and an oversized sailor hat and a lollipop the size of his head and goes, I'm high and I want to get in show business, Mr. Smith.
You got lots to learn.
The crazy thing, I think we probably worked together for about 14 years. Wow. Like everybody you were mentioning, like Jimmy Pardo is like 11 or 12 years. Mm. Andy Kindler's 18 years. You know, these are people I've worked with for a long time.
That's so crazy.
So I was an agent and then I flipped the company over to management. Oh. So, you know, everybody was like, well, you know, I guess if I don't have any complaints about him, I can deal with a new job description, you know. But it really was like you woke up the next day and it was just a smaller version of the same roster.
Yeah. All right. Well, and I hope there isn't any weirdness between this, but like some more insider, I guess, kind of info that I've heard through the grapevine is that it was T.J. Mark Walter, is that my name?
T.J. Mark Walter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was an agent for you. Now he's working
for 17
Gersh.
Years.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And
so you're saying in some way he's turned?
No. I wasn't, because I realized
double
I'm like...
agent kind of thing?
Well, I just remember...
He's
I remember,
a spy. He's working for Leno. Oh, crap.
We can turn him back.
It's Mark Walter. I don't know. I like it. He's got Jay in his name. I just remember looking at that story and going, like, how great is it for these clients that are on that roster that it's like the guy that they were with, now they have a manager that they have this longstanding relationship, and then one of the agents that was working for him now goes to the Gersh Agency, which for those of you who don't know is like one of the biggest agencies, not only just in comedy,
and
but
in
general.
Comedy, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Huge. Yeah. Where it's like, and it for me, like up and coming and learning about the industry and stuff like that, like all of a sudden it became like, lately I feel like that's the place you want to be. That's the place you want to be if you can get in with comedy, you know? Like
I think, you know, what would happen was really sort of organic because it wasn't exactly that split. It was sort of like when I became a manager... TJ became an agent, but it was his own agency, and we just continued to share the same office space. So our biggest problem was convincing the clients why they were paying more commission when they walked in and everything looked the same.
Wait a minute, why am I giving him 10 and you 15?
Two separate corporations.
You're literally eating the same sandwich.
I imagine them all sitting around together.
And you go,
I'm telling you, Smith is just trying to crank out another 10% out of us. He's milking us for everything. Thing we got.
Right.
Somebody else is like, we've been with him 12 years. I was wearing knee highs when I walked in the door and he still signed me.
My sailor hat, he signed it.
If he wants another 10%, take it.
That was the crazy thing is like you walk in and everything looks the same. So you go, okay, I yeah. should be paying the same also.
Right. No,
but for about 2 years, TJ was Pacific Comedy. And he ran his own agency and found out what I'd been warning him about for years when he was my employee. Nothing is fun about being the boss.
Yeah. Right.
Nothing. Yeah. You know, and he hated the paperwork. And, you know, it was right. like he loved like coming in and getting on the phone. And he was very chummy with the clients and very chummy with the club owners. And, you know, I mean, the idea of stopping to do tax forms did not appeal yeah. to him.
Right.
Not the way I enjoy it.
Yeah. For you, it's like, that's why I got into this.
April. I got into it yes. doing tax forms.
Well, and so and that's one of the reasons, too. I'm going to bring it back to it. You can't Please. Dodge this, Smith. You cannot dodge this.
You know what? I may actually be able to dodge this without doing anything the way you're going.
You're right.
Just I may not talk. Have to even be dodgy.
Yeah. Yeah. But to me, like, you almost have, like, your roster, you kind of have the niche of what is the alternative comedians today. Like, that you have a good chunk of them that are
as
out there.
As long as you're not looking at my acting roster, yeah. then what you're saying might be true.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why I was wondering, like, to you, how did this whole alternative comedy scene come about? What was it like? Because I would imagine you had these... Yeah, exactly. You were there when it happened. You had these guys when they started.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, like, you know, these rooms like Largo and now the UCB and stuff start coming up where they support, you know, alternative comedy. And and it's so... For me, and I know I'm a layman in this, for me, what I think is interesting about it, too, is that it's like I come up with what would be considered mainstream or pop. It's like pop music.
Yeah.
That's what I enjoyed.
Yeah, I agree.
And then all of a sudden you find these, like, it's like the grunge scene of music in the 90s. Like, you find these guys that you had never really heard of, but it's like, oh, this is hysterical. Like, yeah. I love it. You know, and then as a comic, and I know I've said this to you, too.
Getting turned on to something, you know, that was always kind of like right there on the periphery.
Yeah.
And, you know. Like, people are always trying to turn me on to musical things, and I usually find that if I was meant to find it, I would have already found it.
Right.
like people are always trying to say, you should listen to this, and then I listen to it, and I go, ugh.
I should not listen to this.
I should not.
So
this is not good.
In your opinion, how did it happen? Or like, is there a narrative to it? Or
there actually is a narrative to it, because, like, now you go to UCB, and it seems to be the sensibility that sort of embraces the theater. So previous to UCB, it was always very much attached to one night of the week in one venue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and UCB is only open like maybe 3 or 4 years now. You know, so in the early 90s, it really all started under one roof. It kind of coalesced under the term on cabaret.
Yeah.
And it was Sunday nights at Luna Park on Robertson. And, you know, credit should be given where credit should be given. Beth Lapidus and Greg Miller saw something and they pulled it all together under one roof, and they basically took comics, you know, it's like, since there was no alternative comedy, it's just like when people talk to you about Jesus Christ like he was a Christian.
Yeah.
And you go, yeah, if it's named after him, then he had to be something else, right? I go with Jew, but, you know, choose whatever you like. It wasn't Christian. No. So you know, like, all these people kind of come together under the roof. And, like, you know, they were all people who were working clubs. And they were from all over the place. Like, David Cross was from Atlanta. And Bob Odenkirk was from Chicago. And Andy was from New York. Andy Kindler. You know... What happened is, it was this place where you were encouraged not to do your act. That was such a simple idea, but actually kind of revolutionary, like a lot of simple ideas. Don't do your act. You know, sometimes they would give you a theme for the night. And I know Handy always liked it better when he didn't have a theme. He thought it was enough that he was already flying without a net. He didn't want to worry about the fact that it's Valentine's Day and he's got to do love material. you know, but... But still, you know, they were encouraged to free themselves from their act.
Interesting.
And it kind of runs parallel to something that I always, like, really, really strongly believed about comedy when I would go out scouting, which is I was very sensitive in an area that most people who do my job do not care, which is I'm watching somebody at a microphone, and all I'm asking myself is, are there hints and clues that if I were to pull them away from that act, that there's still a working, thinking comedy brain there? Because that's what David Letterman is. You know, yeah. he's a guy who used to be a comic, but he's not trying to stretch his old comedy act from the Comedy Store through several decades of late night programming. What it is he learns to trust himself, and you eclipse your act. You become something bigger than your act. You become a way of thinking, a sensibility. Given any circumstance, you know how you would react to it and how you would make that funny in a very unique way. Now, all of the people, I would say most of the people, if not all of the people that were under that roof, had that gift, where it's like they were not a slave to a 45-minute headliner set, and they didn't want to be. You know, even though they came from a place where the regimentation would be, if you work at the Funny Bone, your best chance to get booked back would be to do that 45 minutes of greatest hits.
Yeah.
You know, here were people who made a conscious or subconscious decision to not give a fuck what the Funny Bone liked, you know, and to see it as there was an art form that was bigger than that. And that, you know, if you were going to host a TV show, you weren't going to pull your act along. You know, when I would talk to a comic, the one thing that was always a very telltale sign if I was talking to somebody who was the real deal or not, is if they felt compelled to put jokes into the conversation from their act. It's like if they are trying to kind of do shtick when we're talking, it's like, you know, convince me you're a funny person by being funny in conversation,
be in the moment,
you know, but don't do shtick that you've rehearsed or shtick that you've written and memorized. And that's really what the whole Luna Park Uncabaret thing was. It was like kind of freeing you, untethering you from that idea that you had to do that headliner set everywhere. And what started to happen is, you know, you turn around and Roger Corman's in the audience, and you turn around and Quentin Tarantino's in the audience, and you go, there's only 75 seats in this place. This is not the obvious kind of hot ticket place, but you started to feel like it was what you'd read about in comedy histories about the Greenwich Village in the early 60s when Woody Allen was performing, or Mort Saal. And you'd feel like, oh, you know, we're going in a good direction here. And it's not that every moment paid off. It's not that every thought paid off. It's that you knew they were flying without a net, so the trip was more engaging, you know, and you really felt like plugged into the moment and the danger of it, and the understanding that they couldn't really wander for very long in that comedy desert before they had to get to an oasis. You know, they were still bound by the rules of comedy that you had to hit.
Taking
the
this
funny.
Analogy,
but no, I do get that, because I'm in the middle of that right now, whereas I'm starting to feature in Funny Bones and improvs, but it's like every place...
Throw your act. Yeah. Don't do it. That's what he's telling you.
No, I can't.
Put it aside.
Because I... Like how I'm just... Here's what I'm really coming from, is that how freeing that... Initially, I could understand the fear, but once you're in the throes of it, it's like these guys that have learned that skill, it must be so, like... You just must feel free. Like it's
Like you're describing the difference between stand up as a written form and improvisational comedy.
I'm trying to actually differentiate a funny person from a person who is a slave to a script.
Got it.
You know,
who can write like, and then I'm not saying that this is what Bruce is saying, but like a prime example is there's Craig Shoemaker, the Love Master, is a very popular comic.
I was having such a good time. Why did you have
I'm
to...
Sorry.
Cool.
I'm sorry.
He's leaving. He just got up.
He, from what I understand...
Keep your damn podcast.
We were having a pleasant conversation.
I don't know what I did.
You better go apologize.
But he has his 45-minute or an hour-long set that he does, and the reason that I know that that's like his thing that he's done for years and years and years is because there's been instances where he gets heckled and he just mows right through it.
Interesting.
Yeah. Or if it's something that he can't handle, it crumbles. He just crumbles right there. And if he has to try and remember where he has to pick up, you know, and
to be in the moment is very freeing. Actually,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. And that's,
I'm in it right now. I started writing this.
Well, now it's gone. It's gone. Yeah. That movie, the moment you were in is antiquated.
You're
to
right.
be fair to you, Bruce.
It's true. Hang me with my own philosophy.
So, but the difference between a funny person in the moment and a funny person, like, where is that difference lie? Because you could be a funny person in your own room and you can write funny jokes and then you get up on stage and say it.
Yeah.
What's the difference between that and being able to be funny right now?
I you know, I look at it like art, you know, it's like, you know it when you see it.
Right.
You know, it's like, you kind of, oh, okay, you know, it's like, but it's so subjective, you know, like you were talking before about your brother who, brother-in-law.
Yeah, loves Leno, yeah. Yeah,
so you get to say that you're not directly related to him.
And it's by marriage, so I'm further, as far away as I could be.
Right. It's a total it's different
still be
gene pool.
Related.
But, well, it is from Modesto, so you're probably in the same gene pool somewhere.
Well, I mean, yeah, but.
But you learn very quickly that you know, nothing about comedy and the subjectivity of comedy, nothing about it's negotiable, mm-hmm. right? Like, you cannot convince your brother-in-law that he's wrong and that you're right.
Ah, interesting.
You love Conan the way he loves Leno, and, you know, there was this, you know, a phrase I used to do that's like out of a left-field phrase where I would go, okay, I understand what you're saying. It's all subjective, except for one thing. I'm right.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because it's like, artistically, I know I'm right. Artistically, I know that, like, if you wanted to compare the Beatles to the Monkees, the Beatles are the real deal and the Monkees are a fabrication.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't mean the fabrication can't have elements that are enjoyable.
Yeah. And for our listeners, it's the same as, like, NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys.
Yes, continue. Your listeners have no sense of musical history.
No, I don't know. Maybe I'm not giving... I know that there's at least one pothead who is going to wait until, like, midnight when this comes out, and he's not going to know who the Monkees are. Michael, if I'm wrong, send us an email.
I have no 2010 defense for the Monkees, but the Beatles... You can buy Rock Band, and I think that would be
that'll take
the modern
care.
Explanation.
Yeah, there is no Rock Band for the Monkees.
No. One day.
When weirdly enough, the Rock Band has jumped the shark, that's when you will see Rock Band the Monkees,
right.
Because they've literally exhausted almost every other band.
It's either the Monkees or NSYNC. Well, let's Monkees seem more classic.
But I want to play Backstreet Boys.
Monkees.
No, 98 degrees.
But don't you find yourself in those conversations all the time?
Yeah, like exactly.
Where it's like, no, 30 Rock is a good show.
Yes.
And 2.5 Men is like, that could have been made 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And, and you're really like, you know, just kind of shouting into the abyss. You know, it's like you're never going to win the argument. The people who love 2.5 Men and say 30 Rock is, you know, inside or indulgent or they don't get it, they're going to continue to not get it because that's the way their brains are wired.
Yeah.
See, that's why
I
find it so unusual for me to like The Office and have most of the country also like The Office, because I'm used to liking things that most people don't enjoy.
Yeah.
Like Arrested Development went away, and which is a brilliant
show. It was a great
show.
Yeah. I was shocked. Yeah. I was shocked that people wouldn't get behind such a hysterically funny show.
And I wonder if it came out now, how it would do. Like, people have a different
sensibility. If it was before its time, like it paid
the
way.
I think so.
I think, or you know, sometimes it's on the wrong network. You know, it's like when that Kelsey Grammer, Patricia Heaton show, Back to You, was on Fox.
Yeah.
It was like a CBS show on Fox.
Yeah.
It did not belong on Fox.
No.
And it should have never been made for Fox. And then you kind of go, you know, the critics kind of like that show, and yet it died so quickly.
Yeah.
The audience that was there at that network was never meant to embrace that show.
That's a solid point, is that I think that a lot of people don't take into account the idea of the network having a brand of style of show.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Where it's something
like,
they've done.
Like a prime example, I think, right now, like what we were kind of talking about before the show started, was Modern Family. To me, Modern Family is kind of a spin away from The Office, but like if The Office were to do a family style sitcom, that's what Modern Family
and that's
is.
That's exactly how it was conceived and thought of.
and now we've come full circle.
Proudly, you know. I mean, I think, you know, you can kind of. I mean, the show I was just talking about, Back to You, is created by the same people who created Modern Family.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And I think, you know, there's kind of a conscious, you know, what is it that people are watching now? You know, it's like you always, but like for me, you know, I've been out in California doing this for 20 years, and I've been an agent for 25 years, and I feel like it's really important to kind of hang on to where the edge is located, you know, and not to kind of become stodgy in your taste, and not to kind of become old fashioned, and not to say things about the Beatles and the Monkees.
No, they're still cool.
Because then you start to sound your age. But,
Rock Band brought it back. It's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
You're what, 33?
Yes. How old does my voice sound?
34.
Well,
I'm young in spirit.
We're out of time.
I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not cutting you off, am I? Am I cutting off? Is there anything now that this is a time for
now
plugs?
Now that you got me going,
Well, I want to know, do you think the office has jumped the shark? That's the question that I need to find.
Yeah, in an entertaining way.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I'd say it jumped the shark. I'd say it freed itself from the bonds of a British show that was that only ran for 6 episodes and 1 Christmas special.
Right.
I think they had to go somewhere, and I think the audience liked where they went, as opposed to Fonzie when he actually jumped the shark.
Physically
and the
jumped over.
Did not enjoy that.
I'm curious to see what happens now that Jim and Pam are married. It just feels like they've run out of story. And I'm interested to see if they'll be able to reinvent themselves.
That's why they have 35 regulars.
It's
true. You can always just move into. We haven't really explored Meredith and her drinking problem.
Exactly.
More of her.
Here's the thing. I don't know if I fall into that Midwest category, because honestly, when I watch that show, I don't feel like it jumped. I mean, the clip show didn't help for me. I was like, wait, is this a sign you're phoning it in? And in my defense, I think somebody needed an extra week of vacation.
Yeah, you were right. So I appreciate that. I give them the break for that.
I called it.
There's a new Steve Carell movie coming out, then I'll take it, as long as it's not Noah's Ark 2.
What if that movie, though, was a clip show? Oh, that's disappointing, then. Oh, Steve, you need an extra week, really, to take from other movies? You son of a bitch. We trusted you.
It's just clips of the monkeys.
You.
Hardly knew ye.
But is there anything else that you want to plug or like a website that people can go to find all your
you
clients?
You can go to omnipop.com. You can find all our clients there.
And please, seriously, here's the thing. I apologize for my ignorance to the acting segment of your roster, but I can tell you
there's people who are not stand-up comedians, and they have sad lives. They wait for the phone to ring, and I say, you got an audition, and they go, really? Hope springs eternal. The next day, back into a depression.
But please go to omnipop.com, check out the comedians that you have, find their album. It's definitely worth the $9.99. You can buy most of them on iTunes. I recommend any of it. I can't do that. I was going to say, or I'll burn you one and send it to you. But
not what he's sitting right here.
I can't plug because it's 25 clients.
Exactly.
You'd just be plugging.
I'll just put a bed. I'll just put a looping bed and just. We'll do that. Mary Melly.
And then it'll be the client that I never dreamed of, that listens to this podcast and goes, you didn't even mention.
Right.
I did Chelsea Lately.
I had a short story that was published in Esquire.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah,
I appreciate it very much. On behalf of our guest, Bruce Smith, Kevin Miller, I'm Justin Worsham. Okay, bye. Thanks for listening to the Second Funniest Podcast. You can reach us at 408-228-4911 or send us an email to podcast@justincomedy.com. Please, once a month, vote for us at Podcast Alley. Also, check out our store at cafepress.com/justincomedy. All this information is available at secondfunniestpodcast.com. Got some dates for you. I'm going to be at the Omaha Funny Bone January 27th through 31st. I'm going to be in Los Alamitos at the Gate on February 2nd at 9 o'clock. I'm going to be at the Sacramento Punchline March 11th through 14th. The Laugh Out Loud Comedy Club in San Antonio, Texas, March 17th through 21st. I'm going to be co-headlining at Wits End in Westminster, that's in Denver, near Denver, Colorado, July 14th through 18th. I'm going to be coming back to Rooster Teeth Feathers July 22nd through 25th.